The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Tuesday, the 19th of March, 2019. On the podcast today, Aidan Bishop, the founder of Big Dish. Ticker there is D-I-S-H. And Aidan discusses their partnership with Loudmouth Media and other operational progress. Also on the podcast, Paul Bassey, Chief Executive Officer of Real Estate Investors, RLE, is the ticker there. And Paul summarizes their final results, which were released today. Plus, Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications, talks about the following companies: Loco Soco Group, Petrol Resources, and iEnergizer. And as always, I have two lists for you. The top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see a whole lot of other content from other companies. We've got a story there about Rehable Resources, also a story about Big Dish, and other things there, videos and interviews. Check it out, voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Aidan Bishop, founder of Big Dish. That's D-I-S-H. Aidan, thanks for coming on.
You're welcome.
Now, you've got a plan there with Big Dish, and you're rolling it out, and of course, you brought a new CEO on, a very experienced guy there in Sandsnaha a while back, and it looks like, you really are regimented in slowly but surely marching out across, or rolling out across the UK in different areas, and you've announced today a sort of partners with Loudmouth Media, and we'll get into what that means and significance of that. But before we do, as always, if someone's listening right now, never heard of Big Dish, how would you explain it to them, Aidan?
Very simple. Big Dish is all about dining smarter. That's one of our hashtags, dine smarter. What that means is we allow restaurants to fill excess capacity, particularly in quieter times. And to the consumer, we allow them to access some great offers and deals, predominantly during quieter periods. Consumers can get up to 50% off the food at a great selection of restaurants in a number of places, currently around on the South Coast, but expanding around the UK.
Yeah,
very soon.
And what's, I mean, ideally, what's the target here? You know, how many restaurants do you hope to be in?
Well, what we are looking to do is to be in 6,000 restaurants. We think we can achieve that over a two-year period. The makeup of that 6,000 restaurants would be probably about a third of that would be independent type restaurants, then you've got small groups, and then you've got big chains. At the moment, we only target independent restaurants and small groups because we don't want to be swamped over by one chain. And if also chain restaurants would be slightly different, we'd have to make some further development on our tech to accommodate chains because they're slightly different in the way they would operate to independents.
Okay. All right. So 6,000 in 2 years. And you've announced today you're partnering with Loudmouth Media. So who are they, and why are you doing this?
Well, we're doing this. I mean, everything we're doing at Big Dish right now, and I think we've tried to put that across in the RNS, is that we're building a launch pad for UK growth. So basically what we're doing is creating this platform, or launch pad as we call it, to bring about a day where we will say, push the button now, let's go all over the UK. And there's several aspects of the business or components that need to be in place in order to be able to push that button. And the tech, of course, is important. And the app is very advanced. We know the new website is still targeted to go live this month. The restaurant acquisition is another key component, which has been going well. And also and this is what today's RNS is about, is the customer acquisition side. And so that's why we've partnered with Loudmouth Media. They are an award-winning digital advertising agency, and what they will do is they will come on board and they help us get the message out. And the goal of over the next few months will be to determine what are the most effective marketing channels to reach the consumer, and from that data, what is the cost of customer acquisition.
Yeah, okay, cool. And you've announced that Southampton has gone live as well?
Yes, we took Southampton live basically on day one. So one of the reasons we did that was I think we just started with a couple of restaurants. And now there's more and more are signing up, and which is great. And one of the reasons we did that was Sandra was telling me that when talking to restaurants, that it's really good to be able to show restaurants the app and show that their area is already live. It creates an urgency. They can see other restaurants that are coming, you know, that they might be familiar with, and help them or motivate them to also partner with Big Dish. So Southampton is live.
I suppose if you show a restaurant that their competitor on the road is on your app, that would motivate them, wouldn't it?
You would think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, I've looked at it because I'm in that area, and you realise you are starting to build there. But it's true. I mean, you know, it's proof of concept, isn't it? If you've got no restaurants, it makes sense. If you've got no restaurants in that area and you're pitching that area, it's a harder job, isn't it, I suppose?
Yes, look, I think we'll be at 20, but I think we'll be up to about 20 in Southampton by the end of this month. It's going well. Bristol's going well. We're going to see more come on to Bath, added to Bath next month as well. And also in today's RNS, we talk about a third territory that we're going to be expanding into, yep. And that will kick off with Brighton. We're looking to do that in April or May. And also another town that's going to be added into, or city that's going to be added into territory two, is going to be Exeter. And so we'll be looking to also go there in April or May. So everything we're doing is moving towards the time when we can say, right, all of the three components are in place now, we're ready to go. Bang.
Yeah, so that's the talk of this launch pad, you're saying, yeah? And so do you have any idea of when you will be ready to sort of give it the big push?
I do in my head.
I do in my head, we sort of know,
but look, there's a couple. I think we're sort of giving some signposts to people. The new website, of course, that sort of ticks the box on the tech. We've basically said we've ticked the box on restaurant acquisition, and now this consumer marketing is kicking off, and that's a key component for us as well. And then it's just going to be a matter of recruitment, basically, and recruiting territory managers, and off we go. But it's I sort of got a fair feel for when I think that moment will be, that when we will be able to announce that. But it'll come.
How big is the team now? Because I'm assuming you need to get out there, you know, selling this. So how big is the team at the moment?
Well, we have two territory managers still. We've just made an offer to a third person that's accepted, I understand. Mm-hmm. So we've got on the ground two, about to have three, Sanj. So the UK team is still pretty small, it's never going to be big. It doesn't take a huge manpower to get this job done. Of course, our tech team and engineers and product team is based in Asia, and that will always be the case. And we also have a marketing person in the UK. I forgot to add him as well. Yeah. So we've got the UK team is currently, including Sanj, four people, with a fifth one to come on board soon.
Yeah, I suppose a lot of it can be done remotely, can't I? I mean, so I'm serious, Sanj, what you do, look at decent restaurants on TripAdvisor and all that stuff, and then approach them, and then maybe do they go for a face-to-face meet, or is it just done via an email or what?
No, there's a couple of ways it is done. So physically walking into restaurants, just like going into them ad hoc, is one way to do it. You have to pick the right time of day. Of course, it's always good to go in when the restaurant's empty, because you can sort of prove the point of your management, what it's all about. Yeah. So that's quite an effective way, because ultimately you've got to reach the decision maker in the restaurant. So you get to know what sort of time they're going to be around. Telephone appointment making, that's another part of it as well. And of course, when it comes to groups, and you're then dealing with like a head office or marketing department, and it's a different type of sell. So That's how it's done. So the remote, what can be done remotely is there is a telephone aspect to prospecting new restaurants that can be done remotely. But the rest of it is pretty hands on. The best way is to go to sit down with them face to face. I think that's what the hospitality industry seems to like, and that's the way we do it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you say, you know, in the last part of the RNS today, you say your current focus is on independent restaurants and small groups, like you said, but conversations are taking place with the big, large restaurants, which have longer sales cycle. But you expect progress with the bigger groups as the year progresses, yeah?
Oh, no, we're totally confident that we're going to have some big groups join us based upon the conversations that Sanj has had. When Sanj was at Booker Table, he was brought in to bring the big groups on to Booker Table. So he's pretty confident that he'd be able to do the same thing with Big Dish. So the sales cycle is different. The way they administrate their account tends to be centrally rather than on a per-restaurant basis. So we'll have to make a few changes there. And, of course, there's a number of different departments within big groups, so you have to get the buy-in from a number of areas. So that's why the sales cycle tends to take longer. And what Sanj says is that they tend to also run it as a test for a few months and then look to roll it out. So, you know, we're confident that we can get that. Of course, once we do press the button and go and create this national footprint in the UK, then, of course, it's going to be a lot easier to bring restaurant groups in because we'll also have restaurants in areas where they are.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. Okay, well, by the way, I mean, I know you, I suppose this happens in Asia, like you say. Are there other parts of the world that this is happening, this kind of yield management on restaurants?
Yeah, look, it's. I mean, the first time I ever saw yield management was in New York, actually, and it was a company called Savored, and they were bought by Groupon. I think it was 2012. And Groupon saw them as a threat to their voucher daily deal model, which it undoubtedly is, and then they bought it and closed it down. So that was the first time I saw yield management in operation. I mean, some restaurants are doing yield management on a local level in a very sort of simple way by just having their own specials or their own happy hour or something like that. It's just that with Big Dish, it's a platform, so they all can be accessed from one point, which is the app, and about to be a new website.
Yeah, and that's the nature, isn't it? You aim to be a disruptor, and that's the whole thing, disrupting the industry, and essentially probably someone will take you out. Is that the case?
Well, let's see. I mean, what I do know is that if we do create this national footprint of X number of restaurants within the UK, and we've got a certain user base and everything's working, the tech continues to advance, then, yeah, we will certainly become an attractive acquisition target at some point.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you can't be ignored then. So finally, one final thing to do, Aidan. If someone's listening right now and likes the sound of what you're doing but are not following the story, then please give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, as Big Dish largest shareholder, myself, I'm pretty excited about where we're going and what we're doing, and we're sort of fully motivated on rolling this out around the UK. And I think it's a great story and a journey for people to watch. You can literally see how we expand and around the UK. And, you know, food is simple to get. Everybody likes to eat out. Everybody likes a deal. And restaurants don't like empty tables. Those are the three fundamentals of Big Dish.
Yeah, that is good. Marvellous stuff. Aidan, good to chat to you. And no doubt we'll be catching up again in the not-too-distant future. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Bassey, Chief Executive Officer of Real Estate Investments. RLE is the ticker there. Paul, thanks for joining me.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Yeah, it's always nice to have a new company on, because our podcast is listened by, it's very targeted. Basically, everyone listening to the podcast are potential investors. That's what I love about it. And so it's always nice to have a new company on, a new idea, so we can put to people. So first and foremost, Paul, before we get into your release and some impressive results you've released today, let's talk about or summarise the company, please. For people not aware, what is Real Estate Investments all about, please?
Okay. Well, we're a Birmingham-based real estate investment trust, and we're the UK's only Midland-focused property company. Management have been involved for over 10 years now and have made a personal financial investment of £10 million in cash. Our portfolio's roughly £225 million. We have a very risk-averse approach, very diversified. We're a value-add business, and I'm pleased to say that we pay a dividend of 7%. So in a nutshell, we're a hard-working property company, highly profitable, asset-backed and dividend-covered.
Yeah, and so to tell me why. I mean, is it because you basically are you from Birmingham? Why Birmingham?
I was born in Birmingham. The team are all from Birmingham, but actually, originally our estate entity businesses and our property interests were all Birmingham based. And it's the financial crisis of 2008-09 that got us into the public markets to take advantage of the opportunities that we knew we had access to. So, you know, we eat, drink, love, breathe Birmingham, and it seemed the right place for us to invest. And when I say Birmingham, we call it Birmingham, but really we're talking about the wider Midlands.
Yeah, okay, all right. Well, let's look at the results, which show, you know, good growth, excellent growth. So what are the main highlights you would draw people's attention to there, Paul?
Okay, well, our underlying profits, that's real money, are up 16%. Our portfolio is up 5.5%, and our dividend now is up 14% this year, but it's gone up 6 years year on year. But the real highlight for me is the man driving the business is that we have cash and bank facilities of £25 million to take advantage of these very uncertain times that we're living and operating in. The management here are, as I've said, experienced and lived through the financial crisis more recently. We lived through what I would call a real recession in the early 1990s when interest rates were 15%. We've lived through Scottish referendum elections. We know how to take advantage of uncertain times, and we've prepared and positioned ourselves to do that. And I believe we will have opportunities to execute over the coming months.
Yeah, when you talk about opportunities, I mean, it's obviously macro factors can help you in a certain way. I mean, looking at HS2, for example, how important is that to you?
Well, HS2 is one of those things that is happening here in Birmingham. But I think we need to understand that Birmingham and the wider Midlands are going through a phase of rebirth. We're not just about HS2. We are not a one-trick pony. We have HSBC have relocated their headquarters. The Inland Revenue have taken 150,000 square feet. We've got 1,000 new staff coming from them. We've won the Commonwealth Games. We've won the City of Culture. We really are going through a state of rebirth in a very vibrant, buzzy economy here in Birmingham and the wider Midlands.
Yeah. Now, you talk about having an unrivaled network, but doesn't everyone say something similar? And how is your company sort of different here, or unrivaled here?
Okay. Well, I mentioned earlier that we were, you know, did our training, started our businesses here, you know, some 35 years ago. And we still own those businesses. When I say we, that's as individuals. Mm-hmm. We work in REI, but we've kept our equity in those businesses. And it's from there that we get market intelligence about the mood of the property market, where demand and supply is, how many viewings are taking place, how many times a phone rings a day. And that's really what property is about. It's not about location, location, location. It's about market intelligence telling us what to be in, whether it's a sector or an area. And that has been the backbone of the success we've enjoyed over the last 35 years.
Yeah, yeah. And you mentioned there you got a war chest there of £25 million, and you're talking about taking advantage of missed price assets. Can you sort of explain what you hope will happen here then? I mean, how do you take advantage of these missed price assets?
Well, I'm not hoping, because we are living in uncertain times as we speak.
Yeah.
And it's in uncertain times that we've previously had the resources and taken advantage, as I said, whether it was an election, whether it was the European referendum, the Scottish referendum, the financial crisis. I don't think we're going to have a major downturn, but there is uncertainty around. We have cash and bank facilities of £25 million. We have an outstanding track record of executing deals. And I believe we will see opportunities that we'll be well positioned to take advantage of.
Yeah. Well, I'm just looking at the chart there of your share price. Now, it looks like, you know, it's been grinding lower here. Your shares are like 27% below net asset value, and you've got a 7% yield. What is going on there? Why do you think the share price is where it is, Paul?
Well, if this was based on facts, our share price would not be trading at a discount, because the facts are we're a very robust business paying out a growing dividend of 7%. Unfortunately, the marketplace is taking a very downward mood on retail property. And that's brought a number of property company valuations or market caps down. We are not a retail property business. I have to repeat, we are not. We are a diversified portfolio with everything you can imagine, from food stores, discount retail, medical, pharmaceutical, restaurant, bars, coffee, financial, hotel, leisure, car parks. So we are unfairly dragged along in this tide of anti-retail, but we are not a property retail business. We are diversified, risk-averse, and very well spread.
Yeah, well, you could say you are a mispriced asset yourself, aren't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely, we are. We've invested £10 million, I can tell you, at share prices significantly higher than the one that we are enjoying at the moment. But we're not worried about that. We are getting on with running a good business. I'm sure that as things calm, people will understand that some property companies are retail and others aren't. And we are not committed to one sector. We're about value, yield and diversity, and that will come through, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And sort of, just to explain, how many properties do you have at the moment, and do you have a finite amount of, or is it just about the size of portfolio, or what do you look for?
Well, we look to add value to everything. We've got just under 300 tenants. We look to have diversity, so no single tenant is more than 3% of our portfolio. No single asset will be more than 5 to 10% of our portfolio. So we look for properties that we know we can add value, where we can grow both the income and the capital value of the asset.
Yeah, okay. One final thing, Paul. If someone's listening to this right now, looks at the sound of this, but are not yet following the story, please give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, as I said, we're a very committed management team. So number one is the management team are experienced, committed, and we're not asking other people to invest in us only. We've invested in ourselves to the tune of £10 million in cash. Number two, we have an outstanding track record. We're highly profitable. 6 years of continued dividend growth and 10 years of continued portfolio and revenue growth. But for me, the real big reason that you people should be investing in us as a business is because of where we are. I think if I asked people to invest in London 50 years ago, knowing what they know now, they would be attracted to that as an opportunity. Birmingham is in a stage of rebirth. I've talked about the relocations. There are more people coming to Birmingham than anywhere else in the country. You know, our house prices are up 6.5%. London is down 0.3%. We're about tourism, leisure, digital media. Really, it's an opportunity to invest in the rebirth of one of the greatest cities in the UK.
Absolutely. Sounds very exciting. Paul, thank you very much for that. And hopefully we'll catch up again in the not too distant future. Thanks a lot.
Great. Okay, see you soon.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Alan Green, CEO of Brand Communications. Are you all right, Al?
I'm very good, Jess, and congratulations to you and all the Welshmen out there for a fantastic performance in the Six Nations. You know, very well-deserved win. You absolutely annihilated Ireland, and I think we're all surprised by the margin that you beat them by. But also, you know, even more astonishing was the England performance against Scotland. But what can we say?
It was a good sort of end games, I suppose. But it's funny if it was a congratulations. I didn't really do a lot. I just sat down, had a couple of drinks, and watched the game. It was a lot harder for the guys on the field there. But I just genuinely think they knew it was Warren Gatland's last sort of game. There was a grand slam decider. And they finally came out, you know, like they meant business from the first minute they scored. And Wales are always slow to start. And that sort of served them well because, you know, they're used to coming from behind, you know. So if they start going down, it's not game up. And I think England, to a certain extent, even though, you know, have amazing potential, they seem to suffer when they go behind or their plan doesn't go to plan. They don't have a plan B. And like I said, when the current change in Scotland and they started coming back, it's almost like they couldn't stop it, you know. And it got to the stage where Phenomenal. Imagine betting on that scoreline. Imagine betting on that scoreline after half time, because I think they're 31 points up when they England to nil. If you'd bet on that score, you know, excellent odds, wouldn't you? But obviously, you'd be some kind of genius.
You would, but of course, only an avid Scotsman would place that bet. But there may have been one or two that got a huge payout on the back of it. But I mean, you know, who could have predicted that? And right at the end, looked as though Scotland were going to nick, and of course, we just put one back. But as you say, you know, the game plan just went out of the window. You know, they were just literally like rabbits in the headlights.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, yeah. Let's talk about. Things are not important as rugby. That's stocks and shares. What's happening?
Stocks and shares. Okay, three companies to talk about today. Just want to talk about Petrol Resources. PET is the epicode. Want to talk about iEnergizer, IBPO, and also a company that I'm going to start with, which is a company listed on the Wiener Börse, no less, the Austrian Stock Exchange. A company called Loco Soco Group, and the epicode is Loco. Why the Wiener Börse, you might ask?
Why the Wiener Börse?
Why the Wiener Börse?
I can't get access to that at all. I can't get access to ASX or anything. My Barclays stockbroker. I'm quite glad though. I'm quite glad I'm limited. I think there's enough opportunity, honest, genuinely, on the British stock markets. You know, we've got 900 companies on AIM. I don't know how many in the main market. There's plenty there. I think where people get it wrong, I think, is trying to widen your focus. You need to narrow it. You need to hone your focus. That's why now I only look at tech companies that are sub 20 million market cap. That's all I look at. I do funds as well to diversify a bit, but. That's why I think you narrow it, you know, specialise rather than generalise, you know?
Okay, well, I take your point, and I think it's a good point. There are plenty of opportunities on the market, but if you're looking for an opportunity in technology, but more importantly in social enterprise, which is very much the buzzword at the moment, we've seen, of course, over the years how the huge conglomerates have dominated shopping centres and dominated, you've got Tesco Express in remote villages, which basically kills the local trade and the local retailer. Loco Soco is aiming to redress that balance as part of the big push in social enterprise. Just on the shares for a second, they're listed on the Wiener Börse, and you can, if you speak to your broker, you can be directed to trade shares. It's not as easy, obviously, as buying online, but it can be done. But on to the model. So Loco Soco's strapline is sustainable shopping that makes the world that makes the world go round. The Loco Soco sell a range of products. That's eco products and services, and they have built a cashback model into these goods and services. So, let's say, for instance, you are a local retailer in a village. You have an opportunity to buy in Loco Soco cleaning products, eco cleaning products. You retail them out to the locals. You earn a commission. Loco Soco earn a commission, but the commission that you earn, you can either reinvest and spend on other Loco Soco products, or that commission can be pooled. If it's in the case, let's say it's a local rugby club, that commission that they earn for selling those products can be pooled and then can be reinvested into local products, community projects, services, and so on. Now the company is also the business model has been approved by Social Enterprise International and the Fair Shares Association, which is pretty significant. And it's the company have just announced the appointment of a guy called Simon Rendell, who's quite a well-known figure in modern technology companies. But I'll come on to Simon in a second. So the company have just floated. They have a market cap currently of just on 9 million euros. They floated at 30 cents a share, and the shares have risen since the float, and they're currently trading at 75 cents a share. The company, I suppose the closest comparison I can draw here is that we see a lot now about Amazon resellers having sort of generated a lot of money from building their own businesses, just buying and selling and reselling Amazon products. This is, I guess, a similar model, but with the community and the social enterprise element that enables companies, clubs, clubs, individuals, religious groups, sports clubs to earn money from the products that they buy and sell, and to reinvest that money or then use that money to buy the product. So it's a very socially aware product, and one that as the board say helps generate local capitalism. So the board, Simon Rendell has just been appointed as chairman. And Simon has done a lot of work in the past with Vodafone, Yahoo, EE, the telecoms company, Electronic Arts, and VeriSign. And he's on the board of a host of other technology companies. And he's been appointed to the board to help steer the company going forward. The CEO is a guy called James Perry, who's been in financial technology since 19 years of age, and he's worked for a number of major financial institutions. And he's helped to build the model. And the chief marketing officer and director is Alex Marks, who has worked for a well-known radio station. He's also worked for and senior positions for Microsoft and eBay. There's another element to Loco Soco in that they have created Loco Coin, which is a cryptocurrency, the cryptocurrency element of the business, and members earn their currency through Loco Coin. So rather than actually physically take cash for it, the stock is held in Loco Coin and can obviously be spent or saved or put towards projects as I've described. So this is a new model. There's a lot of information on the company website, which is locosoco.co, or also on the PR company website, which is Novus Communications, and that's at www.novus.com. As I say, it's a great model. If you look at social enterprise and look at what else is being done in that field, this is very much a growth area, and this company is the latest player in this sector.
Why didn't they just go on AIM? I don't understand why, because it's got low liquidity on the Vienna Bourse, surely.
Not as much as you think. That there are quite a few British companies listed there, but quite simply, it's the cost of listing. I mean, the cost of listing is a fraction of the cost to list on AIM. AIM listings, obviously, once you're there, yes, there is much more liquidity, but the cost of getting on there for many companies in the first place is prohibitive, and that's obviously you've got Next Exchange as an alternative, but the company has, whilst the business has started, I'll tell you a bit about the targeting of the company. They're aiming to generate 450,000 active customers in 36 months, based on £3 per month earned per customer from a £30 spend, with 15,000 distribution partners. They've already got 50 shops across London, 40 sports clubs across London, and basically the business is now radiating out and will radiate out across Europe. So actually having a central European stock exchange listing will make a lot more sense for them.
No, it doesn't. Well, listen to me. So I'm not interested at all. So I can't even access it. I can't even access it. So, and I don't know anyone ever who's invested on the Vienna Bourse from as a private investor. Do you?
I do actually. Yeah.
Who?
Well, several investors I know. I won't name them here, but
honestly.
Yes, indeed. One chap that also invested in the company that I was involved with about 5 years ago. So there are quite a few people.
No, you say quite a few. You mentioned one.
Okay. So compared to AIM, yes, obviously the liquidity is lower, but at the end of it, it's getting the company listed. So there's a place where people can buy and sell the shares and build from there. But the actual mechanism to list the company is I wouldn't say it's academic, but it saved the company a huge amount of money compared to listing on AIM. But it's the actual model I think people need to take a look at, and that's the important thing with the company. Have a look at the model, have a look at the company, check them out, and then DYOR.
Yeah, no, I understand this costs less, but the thing is, the reason why it costs less, because, you pay for what you get, didn't you? And you're less liquidity, you get less access to funds, you can't raise as well, people can't buy and sell as much, so it's you pay for what you get, I suppose, you.
Well, they raised $250,000just before Christmas in the run-up to the listing, which took place 12th of February.
It's tiny, that is, isn't it?
They've just raised a further $250,000, and those shares will be admitted to the market in a few weeks' time. So that's it's all on the information memorandum as well, which can be found on the links that I've given. So. Anyway, there we are. Well, Loco Soco Group.
I like the idea, but it's just I'm just not going to attract a lot of British investment because it's just, you know, in that small market. I think, like I said, they've raised $250,000 and $250,000 again, so they could do, you know, that's annoying, that is. Anyway, I just get frustrated when I hear about things and all that. I can't access it. It's almost like tell me about something I can't get there.
Just look, you know what we do on this podcast is we try and provide as broad a spectrum of opportunities as possible and ideas. And this is an idea. Okay, I don't believe anyone has ever talked on the podcast about a company listed on the Wiener Börse before. But,
no, yeah, I know.
Here we are.
Well, Al, if it was an award for obscure listings, you would get that award. That's excellent. There we are. And next week we'll try the Zimbabwe exchange. Okay. Right, anything else we can actually buy?
Yes, okay, here we are. Right, so Petrol Resources, PET is the epic code, currently has a tiny 1.4 million market cap. Shares were traded as high as 4.25p, as low as 1.2p, currently trading at 1.35p.
Is this from AFSAL?
Beg your pardon, just...
Is it from AFSAL?
No, this isn't from AFSAL at all. No, this is purely of my own volition. After we spoke about Clontarf Energy a few months back.
So, isn't they?
I've taken a closer look at petrol, and I like what I see. Firstly, let's talk about Ghana. So there is an extremely high potential oil field that is just off the Ghanaian and Ivory Coast coast. It's called there are a number of licenses, and you've got companies like Tullow Oil, NI, the Italian company, Hess and Acre, and closest to shore you've got the Tano blocks, which are owned by a Ghanaian company, which is 60% owned by Clontarf, and 30% of it is owned by Petrol Resources. Now there have been issues with the Ghanaian state, but the company is run by John Teeling, who's an oil industry veteran, been in the industry for some 30 years, and also David Corgan, who is the CEO of Clontarf Energy too. So we have this, we have the fields here, we have Tullow, NI, Hess, Acre, and other companies operating fields further offshore. This is an onshore field, so arguably it would cost even less to get the oil out of the ground once the company comes to an agreement with a farming partner. Petrol also has resources in Iraq, in the Western Desert, Block 6 and the Mergen oil field. But it's also last year with Woodside Energy has a 10% stake in what they call the Frontier Exploration License, which is in Southwest Ireland, not far from some of the licenses that are owned by Europa Oil and Gas that we discussed a couple of weeks ago too. So it's a company with a bunch of assets, not a great deal happening at the moment, but it raised $400,000 last year, 1.85p, so well above where we are now. We're in the run-up to a set of results in June, and given the activity in Ireland with EOG, it just struck me that Petrol's got a sizable stake in a license that's not too far from these licenses. So it's not a one-trick pony. You've got, obviously, the flagship, which is the Tano block, but it's something starts to happen in Ireland, then petrol could get a free ride along the way. So one to watch. Clearly a great deal of risk with small oil and gas companies like this, but again, looking at where the shares have been, where they've traded, shares can go down, but where we are now looks like a reasonably good point to buy in if you're looking to take a punt on a small oil and gas company.
Yeah, it is a punt. So, you know, it's like I say, it's a tiny market cap. Was it 1.1 or million quid? No volume traded a day, so it's very liquid. They raised some money back in September, but literally it is a punt. And I had a punt in them about 6 months back, I think, and because there's rumours about things happening there. But do you know what? In a that's quite a dodgy jurisdiction. Apparently, they were making headway last year, and now we've heard nothing. You know, so I don't know what's going on there. So in September last year, I think there's some discussions regarding Canada. They believe they've resolved an outstanding issue with the Ghanaian National Petroleum Board. But I mean, do you know what? That was in September. What's going on there? Mm. And do you know what? In fact, I did talk to the chairman and CEO of Eco Atlantic Oil and Gas, and they're very big in the areas there in Africa. And he said they used to have a license in Ghana, but they gave it up because it's just hard work. The country is it's pretty much not open for business. If it is, it takes too long. So they say they've resolved it, but like I said, I don't know. In my mind, it's an avoid. It's too risky. And the country's too dodgy.
Okay, that's
two out of three now, Al. I'm not with you. I'm out.
Okay, all right. Well, let's try with this one.
Let's try the third one.
okay. But just on petrol a second. Yeah. Ghana. Obviously, that it's well documented there. But the fact is that offshore, you've got major players producing oil, and it's an extremely potent region for oil production. So, if they resolve these issues, it'll be transformative. Clearly, but also, as I said, it's not a one-trick pony. We've got the 10% of the Woodside Energy or the Woodside Energy license, the Fronto Exploration license, Southwest Island, which is not far from Europa oil and gas licenses that we discussed recently. So if there's any activity there, any upside there, then you know that's another element.
It should move on positive news, you know. It's by no means, like I said, it is a one-trick pony. But all those tricks are very tricky, high-risk tricks, and the pony may not even pull them off. So even though the owner of the pony says it can do lots of tricks, the tricks it does are very difficult.
Listen, the owner might not even have a pony. But
yeah, exactly.
No. But just aside, I think this is it is high risk, but it's not. You're not just betting on one oil field coming off or not. You know, whereas with a lot of the companies, you are. So it was the spread that interested me, and given the market cap where it is, anything, any bit of news, any bit of positive news could make that move quite substantially. But anyway.
Cool. Okay. Well, as I passed on the first two, okay. So what's the third one now? Let's see if we get this one.
Right, the third one. We spoke about this last year, and interestingly, there has been no news from the company since then. iEnergizer is the company. IBPO is the EPIC code. Mm. Now, this company's got a market cap of 228 million. Shares are traded as high as 132p and as low as 55p. And really, since we spoke about it, the shares haven't moved a great deal, which I find intriguing. So, iEnergizer, it's a global provider of business outsourcing. And it has operations within healthcare, gaming, publishing, the legal industries, and provides mission critical sort of business processes to a number of organizations. 12,000 staff across the world. Last November, it reported a very strong set of interim results: 9.5% increase in revenues, EBITDA up nearly 40%, and EBITDA margin higher as well. The chairman at the time, Marco Vassanelli, said that the increase in performance reflected the progress being made by the company across a broad, diverse range of revenue streams. Plus, the company, as a result of that, had a very healthy cash position and was in a strong position to invest in both organic and inorganic growth opportunities ahead. So that was November last year. He's, as a footnote, he said, we expect the same business performance through the second half of the year are confident on the full year outcome. So, here's a company that has legs. I mean, the shares rose on the back of those results last year and really have remained more or less where they are. Having said that, we are in the run-up to a set of results a little later in the year, a couple of months' time. So it is likely that the company will issue some sort of trading update in the run-up to that. And clearly, some may take the view that given that the shares have risen and stayed put since that performance, are we to take this, the chairman at his word that the full year outcome is suspected to be positive from last year? Given the history of the company, I'd say there's no reason why not. You know, clearly there's a risk with all sorts of investment, but iEnergizer do appear to be under transformation, and I think we should have a very interesting couple of months in the run up to the next set of results. And I expect or would suspect that the company will provide a trading update of sorts in the not too distant future.
Marvellous stuff. What's the
IBPO is the epicode.
Cool. Yeah. Current short-term borrowers. I'm looking at their current loans. Well, it's liabilities. I was looking at their cash there. I couldn't find the cash. But yeah. Yes, cool, cash.
That's the thing. They've got a really strong cash position. You know,
$30 million.
So they've kept quiet. There's been nothing since the results. But I mean, I. Given where we are on the reporting front, we're in the run-up to a set of results, so I would expect that we'll start to hear some news in the not-too-distant future. But, strong cash position, which is particularly attractive.
Lovely stuff, yes. And, I think they're quite thinly traded, aren't they? There's not a lot of trading going on there, because there seems a chart there that's lacking a bit of data. But are they 230 million market cap at 228, are they? Pretty much
228. Yeah, 228 million market cap. That's it. So big market cap, but lots of cash in the bank. Massive uplift in EBITDA last year. Nearly 9.5% increase in revenues. Companies looking.
It's funny we say big market cap. You know, I was looking at funds the other day, and I was just looking through some of them, looking at a fund on iShares on BlackRock saying, and it's saying UK small cap. And I looked through them, and some of them FTSE 250s. Well, that's most of them were FTSE 250s.
I thought, yeah.
It's a funny perception. Now, I think small cap is in below 10 million market cap. They say small cap is below 2 billion.
Well, exactly. If you're a £1 billion company, you're almost a small cap nowadays. That's the thing. Speak to a fund manager, that's how they think. And
small caps below a billion. Yeah. I know.
We're talking microcaps, really. I mean, this should be the microcap podcast.
Nanocap should be, isn't it?
Nanocap.
Marvellous. Well, in my mind, that's your last one there. You know, it came up to the mark a bit more. It passed. It was an investment grade suggestion there, and positive cash flow. And
just they're all investment grade suggestions. It just depends
what grade you're looking at. Yeah.
what part of the investment radar spectrum you sit at? But yeah, it's again variety. A lot, broadly very different opportunities. But do take a look at the Loco Soco Group website and judge for yourself.
Hey, listen, there's more risk in petrol, of course, than there is in energy. But like I said, if you have a punt on petrol and they release some nonsense news again about positive soundings out of Ghana, it'll fly. That's the way it is. But I mean, you could be sitting there for ages and they could be raising money again. And having to raise money at that level, they can't raise, if they're valued at £1 million and they've got no trades going through, seriously, and they're an oil and gas company with no revenue. Seriously, how much can they raise? How much dilution have you got there? It's a very risky play. But like I say, they could release some kind of nonsense positive spin of an RNS, and it could fly by like 50%,
Yeah, do your own research. Shares can go down as well as up, as we always say.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? I always say in this day and age, it can go up as well as down, because that's all they're doing at the moment, pretty much, apart from Bidstack.
Yes.
Bidstack's doing very well, isn't it?
Bidstack has rocketed, hasn't it? Yes, yeah. That was a very good call there, Jess. Very good call indeed, yeah.
I wish I had more of those. Look at my portfolio at the moment. I've got literally about 20 stocks. One is up, that's just BT. Which is not one I particularly want to own. And the majority, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 are down. It's feeling, the market at the moment is genuinely feeling like it was last year before the big sell-off, or just after the big sell-off, It's not feeling very nice, is it? Very comfortable. It's hard work.
Well, I have to say, I'm holding Shell, I'm holding BP, I'm holding Astra, and they're flying, and there's a big chunky dividend every quarter. I also bought into BATS as well. I've got BATS. So these bigger stocks are doing well. I'm out of financials. I'm not touching financials for now. I just think, you know, there's too much risk and uncertainty, and we've got the PPI issue rumbling on and on for the banks, and it never seems to end. So I don't see upside in the financials in the short term, but energy stocks, for sure, and also big farmers. AstraZeneca has performed great over the past year, and also, you know, I have some shares in Rio Tinto as well. You know, it's an evergreen mining company for me, but there's risk with all of it. So so you've just got to, you pay some money, takes your choice. But if there's a big chunky dividend en route and you bought in at the right price, then it's worth holding. That's why I hold those for.
Yeah, I'm still quite bearish. I'm like 55% in cash in my portfolio because I think there'll be a sell off and I want to take advantage of some dips and so. There we go. And I will be upping my exposure to dividend paying funds. I own 3 dividend paying funds, so I'll be upping my exposure to those to. So hopefully get some recurring revenue and income coming in. Lovely. Thanks, Al. And we'll speak next week.
Thanks, Just. Speak next week.
Okay, it's time for the top 5 most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at 5. Big Dish, of course. Aiden was on the podcast earlier. At 4, ASOS, ASOS. Of course, results out today. Down, as I'm looking now, just shy of 9% there. They say they are having problems. Retail is generally, I think, isn't it? I think about it. It's a fact. But the fact that, you know, one of those early disruptors, ASOS, is also having issues, points to a wider issue, maybe. Okay. Hurricane Energy, HUR, is at 3. At 2, Bidstack Group, BIDS. And number 1 most followed company is Wide Sells Group, WDC. Of course, announced a change in direction of late, and hopefully speaking to the guys very soon. Okay. Top 5 most liked RNSs come from the following companies. At 5, i3 Energy, a posting of open offer circular. At 4, Greatland Gold, strategic and operational update. At 3, Rheobold Resources, part of appraisal operations update. At 2, Hurricane Energy, operational update. And number 1 most followed company is most liked RNS came from Infrastrata. That's Engineering Design Works Contract Award. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Much appreciated.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.